The afternoon teaching is Marana Nusati. You can come forward just to... So Marana, Mara is death. So Marana Nusati means contemplation of death. And this is one of the several particular practices that the Buddha encouraged, different forms of contemplation, different themes to bring to mind that are liberating. So other ones that are also familiar, Buddhanusati, contemplating the nature of the Buddha, Dhammanusati, contemplating the teaching, Sanghanusati, contemplating the Sangha, Chaganusati, contemplating your own goodness, Anapanasati, contemplation of the breath. So Marananusati is one of these standard contemplations encouraged by the Buddha. And so we'll look at various different aspects of this during the afternoon. Oh, when I'm invited to talk about this theme, one of the teachings that I always find coming to mind is a particular passage, a section from the Mahabharata, which is a long scripture out of the Hindu tradition, the Vedic tradition. And there's a particular part of the story where there are these five brothers, the Pandava brothers, who are the sort of heroes of the tale. And they've been banished into the forest, and they've come across this mysterious lake. And four of the five brothers have fallen down dead. And the last brother is being grilled by a disembodied voice coming from over the lake, asking him all these particular questions, philosophical and spiritual questions. And amongst the many questions that come to ask the prince, one is, what is the most strange and marvelous thing in the world? I think there's quite a range. And if he gets the answers right, then his brothers will be revived. If he gets any of the answers wrong, then they'll all die. So it's a fairly loaded examination. If you have exam traumas in your life, then if you had difficulty passing exams or facing exams, then this is a really intense one. So he knows if he gets one question wrong, it's all over for them. So he has to get it right. And what he answers is, he says, the most strange and marvelous thing in the world is that even though every single one of us, every single living being will enter the gates of death, we all think that it's not going to happen to us. And then the voice said, correct. So that struck me as a very simple, straightforward, potent way of talking about it. That there's this mysterious thing that even though every single one of us is going to die. So when I say these words, everybody in this sala, in this hall, is going to die one day. Now, when I say those words, isn't it weird that that sounds like a strange idea? Well, it's news. It's like the first thought in our mind is, no, that can't be right. Right? But how could it not be true? Every single one of these bodies is one day going to stop breathing, either because we are in a car crash, or we have heart failure, or we're hit by a meteorite, or something will happen to end these lives. It's absolutely inescapable. But yet, when I say those words, every single one of us here is going to die one day. These bodies will come to an end. There's something that resists that. It says, oh, no, that can't be right. So that's what this passage from the Mahabharata is pointing to. And it's a natural reflex that we have as human beings. And if you notice that both within the cultures of the West and many places around the world, there is different ways that we sort of put that reality of death, the inevitability of these bodies dying, we put it at a distance. So even when I was a child, I used to think it was funny that people would say things like, if something should ever happen to me. There's about five layers of conditionals there. It's like, how many layers of padding do you need? If, We can't say, when I die. You know, when I die. Don't say that. You know? It's going to guaranteed to ruin the discussion at dinner parties. You know? If, you know, rather than, you know, when I die, we say, if something, if, as if there was a choice, something that we won't talk about, but we all know what we're talking about, if something should, another layer of conditionals, ever, you know, at some point maybe, you know, happen. Yeah. And so, again, it's natural enough that we cover ourselves in these layers of padding, but we protect ourselves from that fact of our death, that all lives end in that way. These bodies all end up stopping breathing one day. But what the Buddha's teaching points us to is that the more that we live under that kind of fear or that denial, that rejection, or that we go along with that, then we create more of a sense of disease in ourselves. We create more fear. We create more of a quality of instability within ourselves. And so this practice, or this meditation of maranānusati, or mindfulness of death, is specifically designed to go against that reflex, that kind of fearful psychological reflex that sort of pushes the reality of death away, puts it off into the distance. So one of the frequent chants that we recite, the verses that we recite, is what's called the five subjects for frequent recollection. So the Buddha encouraged us to recollect every day. Yeah, I am of the nature to age, I am of the nature to sicken, I am of the nature to die. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And then the last one is, I'm the owner of my karma, born of my karma, heir to my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. Now, to our normal self-centered patterns of thinking, that's all very depressing, right? We'll probably all agree. Yeah, I'm of the nature to age. Oh, don't talk about it, Arjun. You know, don't tell me. I already know. You know, I can't stand looking in the mirror. You know. I'm of the nature to age. I'm of the nature to sicken. I'm of the nature to die. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. So to the conditioned and habitual self-centered patterns of thinking, that's disaster. We want to ensure ourselves so that we won't lose anything that we love. We want to protect and keep and lock things down. We don't want to remember that we're going to get sick or that we're going to die. We seem to hope that's going to happen to some other time or to some other people or not to us. And when we, as we do age, we can feel like, well, how could this be happening? Or as we get sick, like we treat it as some kind of weird disaster, like something strange has gone wrong. And the fact of death we look upon as some kind of intrinsic crisis, or something terrible, something bad has happened in our life, or that the doctors have failed because the person has died. But I'm not promoting sort of self-destructiveness, or not promoting the sort of idea of not treating illnesses, not at all. But it's important to recognize that we die because we're born. You know, bodies are so incredibly complicated and intricate. It's no surprise at all that they don't work perfectly all of the time. I've often mentioned how I did years ago. I was a student at London University. I did a joint degree in psychology and physiology. And after 3 years of studying physiology, I came to the conclusion that the human body can't possibly work. It's too complicated. There's too many things to go wrong. You've got hundreds of millions, billions of chemical reactions going on, minute by minute. And they work. It's just, I would come out of these lectures sometimes and sort of onto the street in London. I think, how come we're all walking? How come even a few of us can see clearly and can hear and can, even run or pole vault? You know, it's incredible, amazing that these things hold together as well as they do. So when we reflect in that way, sickness should be no surprise. And similarly, death, the cause of death is birth. Yeah, we say it's from a car crash or from cancer or from an aneurysm or one disease or another. But really, if we look at it, the cause of death is birth. So with this, to the ego-centered patterns of thinking, this is very unpleasant. Just even hearing the words, even saying the words, something, oh, don't say that. That something in us recoils. But the Buddha didn't encourage us to bring these things to mind because he had a kind of sadistic streak, or he just wanted everyone to be miserable. But what he was helping us to do was to cut through those fearful habits, those limiting and constricting patterns of thinking, to let go of self-centered thinking, and to see life, to understand life in a more broad and complete way. So it's through recollecting that, how could we not be facing death? How could that not be the case? There's nothing going wrong. This is just the natural consequence. So this, as the last of those five reflections, is about the nature of karma. It's like, well, having been born, how could this life not end up in death? It's impossible. It can't happen any other way. And so what that's helping us to do is to break through the self-centered, the person-centered habits of thinking, to see life, to embrace life from a more universal level, as a more nature-centered way of seeing, of thinking, of understanding. So this is what these teachings are trying to help us to do. And by turning the attention to that, then and inviting that in, embracing that, then we are able to shift that view to some degree. Even that moment of when I said, you know, everyone here is going to die, and then one day, you know, obviously not today, I hope. the first earthquake in Hertfordshire in 1,000 years, and the whole ground opens up underneath the sala. It'll certainly make the Hemel Gazette. But I don't think that'll happen today. But that moment of, oh yeah, that's right, huh? That that's the gateway, the doorway to that more universal pattern of thinking, a more nature-centered way of seeing and thinking, and letting go of our narrow ego-centered or person-centered views. Many years ago, to illustrate this, I was having a conversation during an interview on a retreat here. One of the retreatants told me of a dream that she had had, a very, very lucid, kind of clear dream. And it was at a time shortly after there had been the child of a friend of hers had died in a very tragic accident. And she had two or three children of her own, the woman who was talking to me. So she was very concerned about the welfare of her own children, found herself being very anxious and protective and quite worried for their well-being. And then one night she had this very, very clear dream. And in the dream, she woke up. And she woke up in her ordinary bedroom, and it was quite dark. And then she felt this strange sensation in the bed next to her. And rather than her husband lying there in the bed, there was this skeleton. There was this the figure of death, you know, skeleton, scythe, hourglass, the whole thing. And so she and kind of, she said it was kind of like a cartoon, but a really kind of a scary cartoon. So there was this figure of the sort of scythe, death with the scythe and the hourglass, lying in the bed. So she leapt up and kind of and tried to escape, but she couldn't get the door open, couldn't get out of the room. So she sort of huddled down in the corner, full of fear. And what am I going to do? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And then she couldn't get away. She couldn't do anything. And then she heard this strange kind of noise. And she kind of looked up and thought, what's that strange? It sounds like somebody crying. So she looked up, and there was Death kind of, you know, sitting up in bed with tears running down the front of the skull. She said, what's the matter? And Death said, it's always the same. Everywhere I go, people just take one look and they run away screaming, everyone hates me, everyone fears me. Do you think I like doing this job? Do you think this is fun? Yeah. And this is before Terry Pratchett, you know, this is many, many years ago. And he said, you know, what do you think it's like going around ruining everybody's lives wherever I go? And that's my job. You know, I hate doing this, but it's the only thing I can do. And so she found this sort of protective and motherly feeling coming over her again. So she sort of went over and sat down and put her arm, and kind of felt this sort of, ooh, not quite sure about this, but sort of put her arm around the bony shoulders and said, well, you know, don't worry, it's all right. And so then it kind of, Death continued sobbing, and she said, you know, it's really, it's all right, it's all right. And then she leaned over and she was going to give Death a hug. So she wrapped her arms around this, the figure of Death. And at that moment she said, I kind of had this sort of, oh, this is not going to be very nice. Sort of cold and bony. And so she kind of, she closed her eyes as she sort of wrapped her arms around the form of Death, sitting there in the bed. And she said, as her arms closed around the form, suddenly she realized, oh, it's gone. And as she embraced Death, then when she opened her eyes, the figure had disappeared completely, and the room was filled with daylight, and the windows were open, and the curtains billowing in the breeze and the morning sunlight. And she woke up. She thought, well, that was a message. And it couldn't have really been more clear that as long as we fear death, then it has power over us. And when we embrace it, then we discover that in us which is, transcendent over it, which is unborn, undying, that which is free from the death-bound limitations. And in the Buddhist text, you have the figure of Mara, who's like the Satan figure of the Bible. Mara literally means death. And so Mara is always coming along to test the Buddha, sort of put him on the spot and try him out. And the Buddha nearly always responds by saying, I know you, Mara. You know, I know who you are. He doesn't fight against death, but through understanding, saying, I know what you are, then Mara has to retreat and gives up. So the recollections of death and the contemplations that you have in the one of the key places that this is described in the suttas is in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. And in the first section of that about mindfulness of the body, and a large number of sections of that are about death contemplations and imagining the body at various different states of decay after it's died. So, you know, a body that's just died, a body that's been dead for a couple of days, sort of turning blue, getting stinky, you know, body with the skin falling off and the flesh withering away. You know, there's about 9 different levels to the having bones with a few sinews and a bit of dried muscle on. You know, bones held together with sinews, bones scattered, you know, all over the graveyard. You know, here a shin bone, there a backbone, there a jawbone. So those are the classical Maranānusati, the kind of contemplations of death. And they can be very useful. And that's why I had invited this skull. I'm not quite sure who this was once upon a time. But the contemplations of death and the body, it's a way of not trying to sort of freak ourselves out or be upsetting or make things difficult for ourselves, but as I said, it's a way of helping us to recognize, well, look at that. So just as I said, you know, one day all of us here are going to die, and we go, oh, yeah, right. I can ask the question, how many skulls are there in this room? The first thought might be one. Then you think, hang on a minute. We each carry one around with us, right? Yeah. So I'd say there's probably 60 or 70 skulls in this room. But our first thought was, oh, there's one skull in the room. And Ajahn Chah in the main monastery in Thailand, Wat Bapong, there used to be two skeletons hanging there, sort of in little kind of cases in the shrine room. And when people would come, they'd often sort of, if they were coming for the first time, they'd walk into the sala, the meeting hall, and they'd see the skeleton, and they'd go, oh, and kind of, and make a kind of a wide berth around it, or and sit, you know, 20 or 30 yards away. And he would make a point, say, why are you afraid of a skeleton? You carry one around with you everywhere you go. You know, what's so frightening about a skeleton? You're never separate from one all the time. You know, you take it to bed with you every night. You know, it's everywhere you go. So what's to be afraid in bones? You know, but you're happy to be with other people. We're happy to be with, you know, with our friends or family or chatting with others. But then when we see a skull, we think, but yet we're seeing skulls all the time that are covered up with skin and muscle and glasses and makeup and different expressions. But we use these particular kind of contemplations to help us see those reactions that we have, and to help us to break through and say, yeah, look at that. I'm really habitually afraid, or I make these projections, but I carry a skull around with me all the time. Why should that be somehow alarming or different or strange or freaky? Because I live with one. I'm glad I have one. It's really useful to have a skull. You know, nothing strange or difficult or dangerous about it. Another kind of contemplation that we do in Thailand, they give permission for monastics to go to see autopsies at the hospitals in. And so because they know that Marana Anusati, the contemplation of death, is part of Buddhist practice, Buddhist meditation, then the hospital system allows people to go and watch an autopsy. So a number of years ago, I had the chance to be in Thailand, and I went along to an autopsy, and this was at the police hospital. And so we went on a Monday, because they don't do autopsies on the weekend, so they sort of have a lot of arrivals over the weekend, and then they have a lot of different bodies to work on the Monday. And so I'd never been in this situation before, and obviously I'd heard about many other people going to these and seeing this in a way, also reflecting on the body and the body that we live with, and the kind of reactions that we can get through, you know, seeing a dead body or the smell of a dead body and so forth. I've been with many people, quite a number of people, when they died, but never actually seeing an autopsy. So one of the things that was really interesting to me, along with being there and watching the doctors were sort of showing us how things were done and working on the bodies and sort of taking the skin off and opening things up and checking the different organs, the various things. So what was really fascinating to me was that although that was kind of impressive or powerful in its own way, I found myself fascinated by the fact that, you know, there's this sort of young man lying out on the table, and the thought that when he put that T-shirt on, because they'd all died from accidents, because they were it was like the police hospital, so it was people who died through injury or accident or found in the canal or had been in a fight or something like that, and so everyone who had died. It was an unexpected death, as it were. And so it was quite startling to me, but what was striking was the thought that when he put that T-shirt on, he had no idea that was the last shirt he'd ever wear. But when she painted her fingernails, she was so careful, you know, she didn't realize that was the last time she was ever going to paint her nails. You know? When he laced up his sneakers, You know, when he tied the bow on his sneakers, he didn't realize that was the last pair of shoes he was ever going to put on his feet. And so I was surprised at this, that even more than the bodies being dismantled and all of that, that sense of they didn't know. It was an ordinary day, just going off to the building site, and then whoosh, suddenly there's a piece of scaffolding comes down and you know, whacks this young fella on the head, or this woman fell off the back of a motorcycle, or a little boy who'd choked on a piece of food. That sense of that the morning, that morning when they woke up, they put on their shoes, they put on their t-shirt, or they got ready for school or work, they didn't know. And that had a strangely powerful effect on me, because, of course, then if you pick that up, you think, well, of course. But as you're walking out of the building, well, this might be the last, yeah, the last street I ever cross, or this, you know, this might be the last time I ever see the sun, or this might be the, you know, the last time I ever, you know, put my robes on. And that is that kind of reflection on the uncertainty of life is another kind of maranānusati. So along with those other kinds of contemplation of death, like looking at bones and going to autopsies and so forth, this is a very usable and accessible kind of reflection on death. And there's a sutra in the Chinese tradition called the Sutra in 42 Sections. And the section 38 of it, there's a teaching that relates to this, which is very, very useful. And it starts off with the Buddha asking, you know, one of the monastics, says, how long is a human lifespan? And the first one says, 70 years. We can expect to live for 70 years. And the Buddha said, you don't understand my teaching. And then 60 years, 50 years, you know, trying to, one monk after another, 40, 50, 50, 40, 30, 20, 10. You don't understand my teaching. We can't expect to live more than a year. No, you don't understand my teaching. Half a year, you know, 3 months, 1 month, 2 weeks, 1 week. You don't understand my teaching. 1 day, you know, you don't understand my teaching. Half a day. The time it takes to eat a meal. No, you don't understand my teaching. Finally, you know, after this long succession of different tries, one monk finally says, we can expect to live the time it takes to go from the beginning to the end of an in-breath or the beginning to the end of an out-breath. That much we can be sure of. And he said, you understand my teaching. So if you time it, which I've done, it's somewhere between 3 and 4 seconds. So, and I think even medically, if you have an aneurysm, you've got probably about that amount of time between the time when the vein goes pop and you black out completely. So we have 3 or 4 seconds to play with to get our act together. When you know the end is coming, you've got a couple of seconds to play with. So that's a very potent kind of death contemplation. And it's also a very powerful support for mindfulness, because when your mind is caught up with something that you're annoyed with, you're upset with somebody, and your mind is complaining, oh, how could he do that? That's really outrageous. If you then consider, if I've only got 3 seconds to live, do I really want to die with this kind of, with vengeance on my mind? Or, you know, do I want to be upset or angry? Or if you're desiring something, oh, if only I had this, if only I could move house, if only I could get away from this difficult situation, if only I could go over there, if I could be with this person, or I could get that job, then. And similarly, if you reflect, well, if I've only got 3 or 4 seconds left to go, do I want to create myself as being in a state of lack, that I can't be happy unless I've moved to this other town, or I've got this other job, or I've joined up with this other person, or I've moved to this other monastery, you know? Or, you know, join the monastic life, or left the monastic life. But we see how we're continually creating tension within ourselves and agitation. And this kind of reflection is very helpful to support the mindfulness of what are we hanging on to right now? What are we fearing? What are we longing for? What are we irritated about? What are we feeling righteous about? You know, we've got an opinion that we have about the government, or about a family member, or about the ajahn, you know. That Do we want this to be our last moment? Do we really want to be carrying this around? So a way I developed this particular reflection is it only really works if you're not the one ringing the bell in meditation. So I did this for years and years. I lived here at Amaravati for about 10 years, from 85 to 95. And so Lumpur Sumedho was the abbot of the community, and so he was always leading the meditation sittings. So as a standard practice, what I would do, I would say to myself, okay, this is the last hour of your life. Last 45 minutes, last hour, yeah, give or take, when Ajahn Sumedho was going to ring the bell. And so when the bell goes, that's your last moment. And you've got until the sound of the bell fades away to drop everything and get ready to go. And it's a practice I recommend a lot because it's extremely revealing. Because you, even in the meditation hall, you can be apparently meditating, quite composed in your mind. So you're supposed to be meditating, but in fact your mind has gone off on some worry or some plan or some nostalgia or some resentment or some just busyness. And then ding, and you've got from the time that you hear the bell, okay, now where am I, and can I drop that? Can I let go of that exciting project, or that worrying conflict, or whatever it might be, that sense of responsibility, I've got to look after my mother, or what am I going to do about this particular project, or I haven't finished that book yet, and then ding. Are you ready to let it all go? Are you ready to see that it's done? many years ago, I was in California, and there was this fellow called Ken Price, who was a good friend of the monastery. And he's a very kind of down-to-earth, regular American guy. His entire wardrobe, literally, he had 8 pairs of cowboy boots, about 10 pairs of Levi jeans, and about 20 check shirts. And that was all the clothes he had. Nothing but cowboy boots, Levi jeans, and check shirts. So he's a real kind of American country man. But he'd also been involved in meditation and spiritual practice for many years. And he was a very kind of can-do, nothing's going to hold me down kind of a bloke. And so even when he had pleurisy and he was having major breathing problems, he walked 2 miles to the emergency room. I couldn't drive and I couldn't be bothered to call for a cab, so I thought I'd just walk. And so he did that once, and then second time he, with pleurisy and then pneumonia, and he keeled over again, and this time he got a ride to the doctor's surgery, and because he thought, yeah, I really do need help here, so he got a neighbor to drive him in, and he got out of the vehicle and sort of collapsed on the grass in front of the medical center. So the nurses and the medical people came rushing out and strapping him onto a stretcher, and he said, "I'm not sure what's happening." And the nurse said, "Well, I'm not certain. But I think I'm pretty sure you're having a heart attack." And he said, "Well, I'm not ready for this." and this was being recounted by his daughters at his funeral. He said that he told the nurse, "I'm not ready for this." And then as it became clear that he was having a massive heart attack, and then they were strapping him onto the gurney to put him on a helicopter to take him to the heart unit in San Francisco, then they're buckling him up and they're sort of about to take off. He said, "Well, I guess I'm ready now." And then he actually died in flight. He sort of, in the helicopter ride, he passed away. But that, he was kind of laughing at himself. She said, his daughter said, he heard himself saying, "I'm not ready for this." It's like, "Oh yeah, have you been consulted?" So you don't actually have a vote here. But that sense of okay, better get ready because it can happen at any moment. So I found that a very, very useful practice, and we did a death and dying retreat here a few years ago. And I thought I'd try this out with a sort of group meditation. So we took over the temple one morning. We had the women on the one side, men on the other side, and put out all the mats to have all the retreatants lying down on the floor of the temple. And I did a guided meditation of that. Okay, this is your last half hour, 45 minutes. And I didn't tell them how long the sitting was going to, well, the lying, the lying was, or the dying was going to be, you know. So it might be 20 minutes, it might be half an hour, it might be 45 minutes. And then just, okay, when the bell goes, that's your last moment. And conducted in that way, also halfway through a 10-day, a week-long retreat, then it was a really, really wonderful practice to do. Some people couldn't stop giggling. You know, some people fell asleep. Other people had very powerful feelings of gladness, rejoicing of the things that had happened in their life. Other people had a lot of regret. Other people had a lot of anxiety, but then just walking through it, okay, well, is this a time to be hanging on to that anxiety? You know, okay, that was a very sweet memory that you have, okay. Do you want to hang on to it, or is it time to let go of that as well? And we see that the things that we regret that we've done, we can let go of. The things that we resent others having done, we can let go of. The things that we rejoice in having done, we can let go of. The things that we are very grateful and glad that others have done, we can let go of. And so the sweet, the bitter, the busy, all of it, or just the mind that wants to just sort of giggle and like and joke about things. Well, okay, if this really is your last 10 minutes, are you going to be giggling? Yeah, really? Well, congratulations. May it be so. but walking and working through all of that, it was very revealing and very potent kind of a practice. So you can try this in your own homes. So death rehearsal. And to say, okay, I'll just set a timer and put it out of view, and then just walk myself through it. Just see how that, see what the mind wants to hang on to, see what the mind is not ready to let go of, or wants to just negotiate, or that says, wait a minute, I'm not ready for this. to see the things that where the mind is really knotted, those deep regrets, or that. That resentment that you just don't want to let go of. I want revenge. You know? Well, is it really worth hanging on to? So this is a very useful and practical kind of experiment to do and to help reveal those things. But along with attachment to our physical being, and there's also physical death, and Maranānusati doesn't just relate to death in physical terms, but you can extend it to more the psychological realm. There's a famous, oft-quoted statistic. I looked it up today, just to check my facts, and it was called the Bruskin Report. It was published in 1973, and something like 2,500 Americans, women and men, were interviewed. And the question is, what are you afraid of? And number one on the list of things that Americans were afraid of, 41% of the people were most afraid of public speaking. Death was number seven on the list. Only 19% had sort of death as the thing they were most afraid of. Public speaking was at the top of the list with 41%, and they repeated it 20 years later, and public speaking was still top of the list. So this is, I find it's a really intriguing perspective on things. It's like that also when I was looking it up on the computer, they quoted this American comedian Jerry Seinfeld, who commented on this saying, "So if you go to a funeral, you'd rather be the guy in the box than the one giving the eulogy." You know, most people would prefer to be the deceased rather than the one who's having to talk about it, give the eulogy. So what that says to me is that we're more afraid of ego death, of dying on stage, of getting things wrong, looking a fool, being embarrassed, than we are of physical death. And I think it's when you reflect on that, it's to do with I think that particularly in the modern Western world, because there's so much say, there's effective buffering for the body. We can make ourselves so comfortable, and we can kind of dress things up, and the rawness of death, and the kind of merciless quality of death and the dying process is sort of hidden away from us. So death is a sort of an abstract concept, but embarrassment, social failure, being rejected, being unloved, dying on stage, looking like an idiot, those are very real, very tangible. It's not remote at all. And so that we, whereas so physical death is, I mean, many people have never even seen a dead body. Nowadays, you really have to go out of your way to try and to see a person who's died. And often, many, many people, well into adult life, have never even seen a dead body of any kind. So it's sort of kept away from our view. So death becomes a sort of, well, I don't mind dying. I just don't want it to be painful or embarrassing. But ego death, so being rejected, being fired from your job, having your partner walk out on you, having your children walk out on you, having giving Dharma talks and everybody falling asleep or getting up and walking out on you. Yeah, this is death. This is a kind of ego death. Yeah, you're running a 10-day retreat, and there's the retreat manager's running out of boxes of Kleenex, you know, and you know, 5 or 10 people have left by the fourth day. Then you know you can take that personally. This is the kind of death that we can relate to much more easily. So we are identified with our personality, and so that when we're contemplating death, it can be very remote. You might think, well, I'm doing my death contemplations. I'm, you know, visualizing a skull. I've got a picture of a skeleton on the wall. And that might be, we might be quite happy with that. But then if you visualize yourself getting up on stage and saying something stupid, or that, you know, you have, you publish a book and then you're completely shredded in the reviews. Those who have bothered to review your book, give it the most appalling demolition. So then, how do we feel? What's it like when we visualize that? Getting up onto a stage or giving a eulogy at someone's funeral and everybody sort of staring at the floor, looking embarrassed, getting up, walking out, going for a drink. Start to visualize, even saying the words. So probably some of you are having the sort of shriveling. Just even the idea of it is painful. So when we're talking about visualizations or recollections of death, then I would encourage you also to explore those ego deaths and to look, well, what's the kind of ego death that I'm afraid of? You know, that being rejected, being criticized, or being old and needing help. That's why when people say I don't mind dying, but I just don't want to lose my faculties. I don't want to lose my independence. I don't want anyone to have to help me. I don't want to be a bother to anyone. Right? Many people are more afraid of being a bother, and this being England, you know, we quail from being a bother to anybody, that we don't want to sort of intrude. And even when you say, well, look, other people might actually enjoy helping you. Like, no, just don't help me, don't help me. And my mother was like that, and my sister had to develop this extremely cunning ways of just happening to drop in. And she wasn't coming to help. No, absolutely not. But she just happened to be passing by, and she felt like she could use a cup of tea. And then, oh, look, there's some... Oh, could I cook lunch for you? And that'd be nice, thank you. So it was this kind of skillful use of cunning, because my mother didn't want to be helped. And she is by no means alone. So that same kind of feeling of ego death, like being disabled. You can't walk, you can't think clearly, you can't remember things, you can't remember where you put your shoes. Like, it can be very, very painful, and far worse than the sort of the concept of dying, that sense of having to be useless, or like someone who can't even button their own clothes up. They can't get about, they can't remember things. So that is far more, can be far more painful, even just saying the words, you know. You can feel that sense of, oh, no, don't talk about that. But in exactly the same way, it's very helpful for us to, rather than just investing in youth and thinking you're forever young, you know, I'm going to grow old disgracefully, you know, I'm going to get a Harley Davidson for my 80th birthday, or, you know, that well, perhaps, but it'd be more useful rather than visualizing yourself on a Harley Davidson for your 80th birthday, to visualize yourself not being able to walk and not being able to think straight, yeah, needing to have your food made for you, needing to have someone to come and tidy your living place, that, you know, the things that we don't want, we fear, that we kind of feel awful and shouldn't happen. Just let those into the mind, invite that in, just as we would the other kinds of death contemplations, and we find that, well, it's not so bad. And actually, it might be true. It might be that they enjoy helping me, and by me pushing them away, I'm stopping them from enjoying themselves, and they really want to look after me. Oh, what a thought! Yeah. So that I would really encourage that kind of creative use, and that for all of us, there's going to be different ways, different things that we sort of are afraid of, or that we shrink away from, and to explore that, and to let that into the mind. And when we do, just as raising up the fact of death can help us sort of see beyond that, then the raising up the fact of ego death and things failing or falling apart or being rejected, to be able to see, well, how could I be the one person in the world that never fails at anything? How could I be the one person that's always loved by everybody? Why should I be the one person that everything that they do is always approved of by everyone in the world? It's totally impossible. Statistically, it's never going to happen that way. And so that when we turn towards it and embrace it, just like the woman in the dream, sort of wrapping herself around the skeleton of death, then suddenly we find that our mind is just like the bedroom, suddenly filled with morning sunlight and the fresh breeze coming through the windows. This is in a way, the kind of expression of the heart transcending the bounds of birth and death, finding that dimension of our being which is beyond birth and death, which is timeless, that very quality of Dhamma, the Satchitdhamma, the true reality of our own nature, which is unborn, undying. Now, maybe the last also related aspect of this, and the way that Ajahn Chah used to often relate to this was when people would come to visit the monastery, Wat Bapong, when Ajahn Chah was teaching, then he would often ask people, you know, why have you come here? Ma pu arai. What have you come here for? And some say, oh, I've come here to realize enlightenment, Lumpur. And he sort of, and he said, well, what have you come here for? He said, well, I want to practice the Dhamma, you know. Well, what have you come here for? Well, you know, I've come here to make merit for my mother and father. And so ask a few people, and then he'd sort of say, have you come here, has anyone come here to die? And well, not exactly. We'd be far better to come here to die than to come to try and achieve something. And they go, what? And it was a frequent way he would address people to say, you know, have you come here to die? And often, particularly Westerners, you know, many sort of starry-eyed, you know, people sort of coming up on the train from Bangkok. And they, you know, you heard the stories and you're expecting to meet the guru, and you know, he'll look at you in the eye and say, oh, at last you've come. You know, waiting for you as his sort of star disciple. And so he would, you know, deflate that immediately, see. And then he was a very good actor, so he could be absolutely deadpan, and he'd say, have you come here to die? He's joking, right? He's not joking. He's joking. He's not joking. But he was joking, and in a way he wasn't, because what he was pointing to was that if you come here to become something, if you come here to get something, like me getting my spiritual life together, or me getting some merit for my parents, or me getting enlightened, then that is still me doing something, me trying to get somewhere, and the mind is still locked within that the boundaries of what we call becoming, or bhava tanha, the desire to become or be or do something. And that desire to become is one of the major causes of dukkha, of dissatisfaction, of discontent, of imbalance in our lives. And so why say, have you come here to die? But really, have you come here to let go of self-centered thinking? Have you come here to let go of your egotistical habits? Are you ready to let go? Are you ready to see your the I-making and mind-making habits and drop them? And the way of life in the monastery was designed to illuminate to any of those sort of self-centered habits and preferences and to meet them and to see them to be able to let go of them. He also used the expression die, which means die before you die, and which is surprisingly similar. He'd never heard of St. Teresa of Avila, I'm absolutely sure. But she also had a saying that's often quoted, which is, die before you die, so that when you die, you don't die. Die before you die, so that when you die, you don't die. So that might be a bit mystifying to some of you. But it's the same principle. Right? You die before you die, so you learn to let go of your self-centered habits, your person-centered perspective, before your body dies, so that when your body does die, you're not identified with it. So that when the body dies, then you've already learned the body is not self. You know, the personality is not self. This personal history is not who and what I am. These are just convenient fictions that we use in the world. And so I'm pretty sure. I mean, second guessing a Christian saint and a Buddhist arahant is probably not a sensible thing to do. But I suspect that they meant exactly the same thing in that expression. Die before you die. And so that letting go of I and me and mine, just seeing those the self-centered habits, those ego-centered structures as convenient fictions. They're like they're transparent. There's no solid thing there. And when we are able to see our life in that way, when we're able to let go of those habits, then we find a tremendous freedom. And that is what we call deathlessness. And this place, Amravati, is the deathless realm. So I thought it was kind of also appropriate, first of the Sunday talks, in the deathless realm, contemplation of death. So we don't contemplate death in order to make ourselves more depressed, but rather that it's by turning towards death and knowing it, like the Buddha meeting Mara and saying, you know, I know you. But it's through that turning towards it and embracing it, opening to it, then we can awaken to that which is unborn, undying, that which is deathless, the real Amaravati, the real deathless realm. But as long as we're running away from death, or we're negotiating with it, or fearing it, hating it, then we're empowering it. We're sort of making sure that Mara is fully and completely in charge. That's what we're doing when we fear and hate death, both physical death and an ego death or psychological death, but in either way. So one of the last thing to bring up as a death contemplation in this way is how when we are in terms of deathlessness, we are very attached to being understood or being treated fairly. And when we meet with injustice or people misunderstand us or misrepresent us, then it's very easy. And they've got their facts wrong. It's not true. Then we can take profound refuge in being right. How dare they? That's not fair. I never did that. How can they say that about me? It's not condoning other people's bad behavior or the fact they might be lying, or you're not saying that their actions are actually okay, but more about our own feeling within us. And that one of the most helpful practices in this respect, and how to die before you die, is to learn how to be misrepresented and misunderstood. This is a profound practice, very testing. But when people misunderstand you, they say they are making assumptions about your where you're coming from, your attitude. They're saying things about you to other people that are not true, that they're misrepresenting you. And without agreeing with what they're saying, without being passive, to find a place in your heart to recognize, well, that's what happens in the world. Just like the body gets sick because it's such a complex system. You know, how could I possibly expect for everyone in the world to treat me fairly? How could I expect myself to be a fully respected and honored object in everybody's mind, and that no one would ever say anything unkind or unfair or untrue about me? Just like expecting the body to never get sick, or every chemical reaction always to work perfectly, the billions and billions of reactions that go on. How could I expect every person that I've met, that I've worked with in my family, to be sympathetic to my point of view, my perspective? It's asking too much. And so that you find that that to die before you die, in this respect, is to say, to let go of that kind of demand that everybody see you as you would like to be seen. That you are able to recognize that, say, well, if that's what he wants to carry around, may he be happy. It's not true. His judgment is mistaken. But if he wants to make sure that's, if he insists that's true, if he remembers it that way, that's his business, and may he be happy with it. And you realize that when you let go of that, and you might have pointed out half a dozen times, well, actually, you're remembering that incorrectly, friend. That they insist, no, I was there, I remember, Ajahn. Yeah. Okay, well, may you be happy with that. You find that you don't have to carry it around, that you can not be holding the world on your shoulders. As we let go, as we sort of drop that sense of wanting everyone to understand us or like us or treat us fairly, without being passive, without just being a doormat, you realize that you don't have to create suffering about it. You can use even those painful experiences of being rejected or misunderstood or your feelings hurt, that even that, those painful feelings become a doorway to the deathless. And as the Buddha said, Lumpur Samhita's favorite quotation about Amravati is before every Dhamma talk, Lumpur recites that verse from the Dhammapada. Aparuta te sangamatasa he dvara sotavanto pamunchantu sadhang. The doors to the deathless are open. Let those who can hear demonstrate their faith. So the doors to the deathless open through those death experiences. Physical death, ego death, social death, that is often where the doors open. And so we kind of have a really nice door to the deathless, with devas on either side, like the temple, you go, I want one of those, please. So, well, yeah, but often it's the meeting of those challenges that help really crack the door to the deathless open. And then it's up to us, as it says, let those who can hear, ye soto wanto, let those who can hear, those who recognize, oh right, there's something beyond this. There is a quality beyond this experience. Then we demonstrate our faith. We trust that realization of the unborn, the undying, the deathless. And then that's the result of having dwelt on and explored the contemplation of death and dying. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this afternoon. So, and then we'll reconvene about 20 past.